On January 21st, 11 people were killed in a mass shooting in Monterey Park near Los Angeles, California. 2 days later, 7 people were killed in another shooting in Half Moon Bay, a small city on the coast south of San Francisco. It was the 37th mass shooting in the United States in 2023, only 24 days since the year began. So why is it that despite these repeated incidents, gun laws in the United States are becoming less rather than more restrictive? What is the ideology that is driving America's love of guns? Is it liberty and the Constitution, along with an instinctive suspicion of any state attempt to limit access to guns? Or is something deeper, more disturbing, behind the Supreme Court's recent decisions to undo laws that regulated access to guns, coupled with a huge recent increase in gun ownership? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Mapazoglou. Well, it's been a while since the last episode of The Philosopher and the News, and the reason for that is my wife and I had a baby this past summer, and, well, time has been really short these past few months. In fact, this episode was recorded last July. It was soon after the Supreme Court's decision to declare carrying a handgun in public a constitutional right. Soon after that, followed another decision, again by the Supreme Court, that threw away a number of legal restrictions that lower courts had previously imposed on gun ownership in various states, including California, where these recent mass shootings took place. This episode sadly became very timely again, and so this is a good reason to release it now. My conversation today is with Suzanne Schneider. She's the deputy director at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research and a core faculty member there. She specializes in political theory and the history of modern Middle East. She is the author most recently of the book The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism. And her common pieces in places like The New Republic and The Washington Post have tackled this issue of gun ownership in the United States and the kind of ideology that is driving it, and just brings a perspective that goes well beyond, I think, the usual cliches about liberty and the Constitution. And I just found her approach quite fresh and interesting and disturbing. So I hope you find this episode interesting and in a way that sheds light and helps us understand why these things keep happening in America. I'm very much hoping that this is the first of a series of new episodes of The Philosopher in the News in 2023. So stay tuned for more in the coming weeks and months. So Suzanne Schneider, welcome to The Philosopher in the News.
Thanks so much for having me.
So part of the reason we're having this conversation has to do with a relatively recent decision by the US Supreme Court on the right to carry concealed guns. Can you tell us a little bit about what that decision was and how it affects sort of various restrictions that were in place previously when it comes to carrying guns?
Yeah, sure. Well, so just this last June, there was a ruling in New York State Rifle and Pistol versus Bruin as the case, and it overturned a very old New York State law. And that law basically said that you had to show proper cause in order to carry a concealed handgun in public. And this ruling, has implications for other states that have similar laws on the books. So some of these, individual states in the U.S. that have similar laws are, Hawaii, California, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, in addition to Washington, D.C. And so, right, these are also some of the places that are, population centers in the United States that have some of our most densely populated cities. And I think there is a lot of concern about what it will mean to have more people wandering those kind of very crowded public spaces with concealed weapons. Mm-hmm. Some have argued that this ruling is quite narrow and that it really may not be that consequential in the long run, and have pointed to Justice Kavanaugh's supporting opinion that reiterated the right for states to to enact certain, regulations for the sake of public safety. So in particular, he referred to an earlier ruling, DC versus Heller, where the majority opinion said, we're striking down a certain law in Washington, D.C., which we'll talk about in a second, but that, even so, Second Amendment rights, the right to bear arms, are not absolute. And the wording of that Justice Kavanaugh reiterated in his own opinion was that nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. So you have kind of, Democratic states in the U.S. pivoting to carve out as much of the public sphere as possible as these kind of sensitive places where guns cannot mm-hmm. be carried. So there's, some optimism being expressed by lawmakers that they, may be able to legislate around the Supreme Court ruling. So I think, that'd be very welcome to me. But I don't want to kind of lose sight of the larger implications of this ruling, which I think are quite serious for a few reasons. So, on the one hand, it really cements the logic expressed in this earlier ruling, Heller, that held that the right to bear arms applies specifically to individuals. And it's, we might have to just kind of think about why that is significant and what it means to enshrine the right to bear arms, particularly as an individual right. Because the wording of the Second Amendment speaks of a public right, and mm-hmm. seems to tie that right to a militia service, right? The kind of the famous wording, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So, if you're kind of interested in that historical context, it seems to kind of tie, the right to carry arms or to bear arms to some sort of militia service. And in the Heller opinion, the Supreme Court said that is not the case. This is actually something that applies to individuals, that each individual has the right to their own kind of, personal, weaponry. So this was a kind of, I think, if you're looking at the recent Supreme Court laws or rulings about the Second Amendment, I think Heller is recognized as the more significant one than the one that kind of just came down. But the one that just came down kind of really cemented this, individual right to bear arms. But the second kind of theoretical point to draw out here in the recent ruling is that the Bruin decision really doubles down on self-defense. And I'm very interested in this language and how the kind of language of self-defense is kind of popping up in these rulings as a justification for expanded Second Amendment rights. Right. And because, the ruling says that the New York law that was on record also violated the petitioner's 14th Amendment rights by depriving them of the ability to defend themselves in public with a firearm. And I think it's useful to think through the assumptions about the public sphere that are expressed in this type of formulation. Right. That kind of you have your law abiding citizens, the persistent subject in all of these, gun cases, right? Or they face these persistent threats to their personal security, dangers lurking around every corner, and that they have to have this right to respond to these perceived threats with deadly force if need be.
And you'll tell us more about how that ideology of sort of fear and threats gets also kind of propagated by the NRA in the US.
Yeah, no, certainly, but it's just like the. It's very fascinating. The judges are not right. That nothing about this is internally consistent. So they can claim that they're relying on history, but then they'll ignore historical context, right? And
I was going to say, if you have this kind of originalist reading of the Constitution, it really doesn't seem like there's anything about it being the right to carry arms being an individual right. Right? It's very quite explicitly a kind of collective defense mechanism.
There is a kind of. I think that there is a kind of, I'm not a legal scholar, but as far as I understand this, there's a kind of divide here where it is not necessarily it's not the framers' intent, right? It's not the kind of mindset that they had when they were drafting these, regulations, which would seemingly depend on understanding the historical context, right? So for justices, kind of like, late Anton Scalia and now kind of Justice Thomas and Kavanaugh, et cetera, it's not so much this idea of like an original intent of the framers, so much as the literal language of the text itself. What does the text say? What is the plain reading of the text? There's really like a scripturalism here that would be a very fascinating kind of topic to kind of
delve out of Bible study.
Delve into in terms of the kind of political theology that's involved in treating the text of the Constitution as almost this sacred document. So it is the text itself, that is, held to be kind of primary importance in many of these. But yes, obviously the text itself doesn't say anything about self-defense. Looking for internal consistency here, I think is perhaps a fool's errand. More significant for me is that this, the envisioning of this kind of new society in which individuals are both isolated and charged with their own protection and security. Jennifer Carson has this wonderful book, Citizen Protectors, that, tracks this idea of it within American gun culture of the individual kind of being, yes, like the person who is responsible for maintaining their security in the way that this manifests itself through kind of all sorts of gruesome ways in American gun culture. All of these kind of trends are pushing toward this notion that security is an individual as opposed to a collective responsibility, and that individuals have the right to serve and as their kind of own judge, jury, executioner.
This very much sounds like a kind of Wild West sort of scenario, right? Where there is no law, there is no state, and each individual has to fend for themselves, a sort of like Hobbesian pre-state kind of, original condition.
Yes, a new state of nature. Yeah, of course.
And that sort of ties in with this idea, at least, that some Europeans have, that this gun culture in the US is very much intertwined with libertarian instincts, which are powerful, at least in one spectrum of American politics. This kind of love of liberty, the mistrust of the state, a desire to be able to, as you said, defend oneself on one's own if needed. And there's a question about whether this is really what is animating this kind of gun culture, or whether there's sort of, that's a kind of surface explanation, and there's kind of like a deeper explanation, if you like. And you have argued that understanding why Americans are so enamored with their guns, or why some Americans are so enamored with their guns, isn't only to do with this libertarian sort of instinct. Can you say a little bit more about those things, both of libertarian side and what's the reason for thinking it's not the full story?
Yeah, no, certainly, right, back to that Second Amendment language, this idea persists in the popular imaginary that the public must be on guard against, government tyranny, and that an armed, populace was a way of preventing against government overreach. For a long time, this idea has kind of has had absurdist qualities to it, right? Even America's kind of, very all too well armed kind of private militias, think about them squaring off against the forces of the US military. This is right. Lopsided to an enormous extent. Just not to say they can't still do an incredible amount of harm. I think that notion of where American gun culture came from really persisted also in the U.S. In the liberal imaginary for quite a long time. In the kind of the modern NRA in the 80s and 90s certainly leaned into this framing in response to the federal and state gun legislation that was working its way through at that time. They're kind of, Wayne LaPierre kind of had this famous rant about the jackbooted government thugs that were coming to, break down your doors and seize your guns and, destroy your property, injure you and kill you. And I think this became a the stereotype of what animated, you know, certain portions of the American gun owning community. But I just don't think that it really holds much water today. Hmm. And there's a few reasons. One is that, right, and we can trace a few different threads here together, which I've kind of tried to do in some of my own work. One is, why do people say that they own guns? Like, if you do a survey of gun owners right. in America, what's the justification that they give? If you look at these numbers in the like early 90s, they tended to be people who were engaged somehow in like hunting, sports, you know, sportsman activities, outdoors. I mean, I grew up in South Dakota. Everyone had guns because you used them on the farm all the time. It was very, very common to have, you know, rifles hanging from, you know, the backs of pickup trucks in the grocery store or school parking lot, wherever. We thought really nothing of it. Because, you know, it was, you never know when you had to, like, I don't know, shoot a coyote or something. I don't know, this sounds like so crazy, but it is, right. It was
so
a very
self-defense from nature, not the states,
which is right. And I don't want to gloss over, right. South Dakota is a, like, we live in a settler colonial society. South Dakota was a, you know, like the rest of this country was cleared of its indigenous inhabitants, and guns played no small part, in that as well. But that there is, I think, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, you know, if again, I most gun owners seem to express these views that, you know, that weapons were chiefly something for sporting, or hunting or something like this, much less about self-defense or protection against people. And, you know, in 2016, researchers repeated the same kind of, you know, study and found that actually at that point, about 2/3 of American gun owners said that protection against people was the primary reason that they owned a weapon. So something significant had happened here. And whether or not that's something radically new or just an intensification of kind of, you know, underlying trends, it's, you know, is debatable. But, you know, there certainly was an intensification of kind of a fear-based politics, kind of, you know, in post 9/11 in particular, that kind of contributed to a sense of being under siege from both from without, but increasingly from within as well. And weapons as a necessary means of self-defense, given that setting, given that context. And that kind of, you know.
And as you say in your writing, this all happening at the same time as violent crimes actually dropping radically in actual, if you look at the statistics. So it wasn't that, you know, life was becoming a lot more precarious and people really had to kind of arm themselves. It was the opposite was happening.
So
life was getting less.
So life was certainly getting, in terms of like, you know, kind of, you know, FBI statistics and things like that, life was certainly getting less violent. You had a, you know, massive drop in violent crime from the mid 90s to when the survey was conducted in 2016. Life was getting more precarious for many people, though, right, during the same period of time.
Economically,
yes. And I do think that is kind of a part of the story that we have to kind of keep in mind when you see the intensification of these discourses about insiders and outsiders, the kind of, you know, threat, a sense of being under siege and threatened from, again, without and within, that those types of discourses do flourish in times of economic precarity and uncertainty. And what you see then over these last, you know, decade especially, is not individuals taking up guns to guard against government tyranny, but individuals who deputize themselves as agents of the state and want to join in that tyranny to the extent it is directed at the perceived enemies of the state. Who are these? These are the familiar cast of characters. So people of color, leftists, right, globalists, Muslims, so on and so forth. And you saw this pretty clearly both in the, you know, both in the kind of the Blue Lives Matter messaging that's been really adopted by the American right. On the one hand, kind of in response to the kind of Black Lives Matter movement in the US and really worldwide. You see this in gun advertising to civilians that sell weapons by depicting soldiers in tactical gear with the weapons that they are going to, you know, that you can actually buy here as a civilian. With the messaging always being that, like, you can play soldier in your backyard. You don't have to go to Afghanistan. You can have this, like, professional grade death tool at your disposal right here. And so this kind of real mix of, like, military imaging with, you know, in the civilian or in civilian kind of gun marketing, Like, I find this to be quite significant in terms of charting this realignment, where increasingly, right, you have people who view themselves as agents of the state. And we see this, you know, in the US, there's a lot of, you know, highly publicized cases where this has been the case.
Yeah. So you mentioned one of those cases, which I think people will remember, the Rittenhouse case of someone who showed up at a Black Lives Matter rally. I don't remember which state that it was taking place, but
in Wisconsin, Kenosha, Wisconsin.
But he had traveled, yeah, but he had traveled out from another state. It wasn't happening even in his neighborhood, say, or in his state. Had traveled from another state, and ended up sort of killing two of the protesters. He had gone there with a gun, and as you say, with this kind of vigilantist aim, sort of to help the police do their job. And you mentioned in your articles about how, you know, he got a sort of, you know, the nod from policemen earlier in that day.
And yeah. So a water bottle.
Yeah. And you have this quote, you say it's clear that it's not some abstract commitment to personal liberty that drives owners like Rittenhouse to regard themselves as auxiliary agents of the state. It's racism. So can you tell us a little bit about how you see this, the role of race and racism and gun violence and the development of people's arming, the arming of themselves in recent decades?
So right here, too, we can track this through, you know, a number of different metrics. And it's really good to have a, you know, as much as like anti-Black racism is so paramount in the US, it's also, I think, really helpful to have a broader frame that looks at both kind of, you know, domestic politics, but also the United States' international mm-hmm. actions as well. So if you're, you know, looking at a chart of, you know, of background checks, which is the best approximation that we have for the number of gun sales in the U.S., or we even look at kind of the amount of firearms that are manufactured, you know, each year, you see a massive jump after the attacks of 9/11. And it has skyrocketed. Like, the gun sales in the United States have grown exponentially since the turn of the century. And I do think it's important to underscore that as much as this is an intensification of, you know, pre-existing trends, this is not the way things were always. It was not, you know, just the sheer quantity that we're talking about, you know, from 2 to 3 million checks a year to, you know, like, what I think, I don't even know what we're up to right now. I mean, like, en route to, you know, in, like 35 million, 39 million. It's just pure insane, the exponential growth here.
So this is in response to people trying to buy guns, and there has to be a kind of basic background check on them.
Yes.
Before they do so.
Yes. All you know, we get into all the loopholes and ways that kind of you get around these things, but the right, the reality is that the kind of rate of gun sales in this country accelerated dramatically after the attacks of 9/11, and contributed to the sense of being under siege, and that right. But, you know, the effects of this have kind of, in kind of classic, you know, blowback style, have kind of come home to roost. So it is not now just that we have a kind of global insurgency that we need to target through the war on terror, but that the insurgency is at home. And you see this kind of reflected in law enforcement documents. I was just writing about one that, you know, explicitly spoke about the French experience in Algeria as a right, as a model of kind of a failed counterinsurgency model that police in the United States need to learn from as they prepare to face off against anarchists and Black Lives Matter, you know, protesters at home. So you have very, very clear kind of colonial frames and colonial language being applied to the home front to talk about, you know, this, like, you know, domestic insurgency that needs to be put down with the forces of law and order. So this is one way
of... Who are the colonizers supposed to be in this case in the U.S.?
Who are the colonizers? I mean, it's the state. It is the state, and it is the right.
And the subjects are...
Anyone who would push for a different sort of more equitable social order. So, and again, the other here is really, it is quite capacious. So it does include, right, it can be immigrants, it can be refugees, it can be, certainly activists who are pushing for racial justice, people who are, you know, pushing for kind of reproductive rights, certainly leftists, Muslims, like there's a broad spectrum of possible others here. So this is one way of kind of conceptualizing, and putting the kind of racial, bringing the racial kind of piece of this to the fore. Another way is that, right, gun sales, you know, spiked after, kind of famously, after the election of Barack Obama to the presidency. The kind of genuine fear that much of this country had of a Black president, it was one of these instances where you saw one of these kind of, you know, huge spikes on the graph. The kind of original, you know, the protests in 2014, kind of earlier rounds of protests around police violence, pushing for racial redress, have kind of, you know, similarly, you know, seem to propel an increase in gun sales. And people will talk about how they need a weapon to protect their homes from these kind of unruly protesters and rioters who are kind of going to come attack that at any minute. Right, you had this, I don't know if this image made it to the UK or not, but this image of the McCloskeys, this kind of husband and wife duo who are, guarding their mansion with his and hers firearms as mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter protests kind of, you know, march through their community. So certainly there is a sense that, you know, that any, yes, if, I mean, if you take the claims of racial justice seriously, that they do threaten these entrenched hierarchies, and people like McCloskeys view that as a threat to their very person, right? They cannot imagine a kind of more equitable social order, because it can only be something that comes at their detriment. So I, you know, again, there's a lot of different ways we can think about this and trace them, but I guess the final one that I'll mention is, I mean, we haven't even gotten to police shootings, as a whole other kind of subset of gun violence, right. And, you know, noting how the intensification of a civilian gun culture also tracks the militarization of the police, right? That these things do seem to kind of proceed in tandem to produce this society, which is just becoming more and more punitive and more violent, seemingly with every day. But then, you know, the kind of final example I'll give you here is, a case like the men who chased down and murdered Ahmaud Arbery, so kind of Black man outrunning in kind of suburban neighborhood. And, you know, these men chased him down, thinking that he was, you know, claiming that they thought he was the culprit who had been responsible for a string of burglaries in the neighborhood. And that, you know, claimed at the trial that they were attempting to make a citizen's arrest when he was killed. So you see this, again, as like people who are clearly deputizing themselves as agents of the state, who are, who have a very outside sense of risk that really borders on kind of, you know, absolute paranoia toward whomever they define as other, and are now armed and deputized to go and take actions that will be justified. And as long as they can say that they were, you know, fearful of their life, that this was in self-defense. This kind of brings us back to why that self-defense framing is so important in this recent Supreme Court case, because, you know, people's perception of risk and safety and security, these things are highly subjective. And so this claim that you are acting on the basis of self-defense, I think just really opens up the whole kind of can of worms to more of this kind of like vigilante action of people who are claiming to be, you know, acting out of the good of their hearts.
Yeah, so, I mean, 2 points. On the one hand, obviously you mentioned sort of police violence, and that seems to kind of enable or justify or make it seem like a justifiable form of violence when, you know, even if you are making a citizen's arrest, that you are allowed to exert sort of completely disproportionate violence in the process, like, you know, sometimes police end up doing. But the other point is that the law is already protecting a lot of these people, right? So a lot of these people end up being acquitted. Acquitted in court.
Yes.
And so the state itself is saying, yes, this is a justified form of behavior.
Yeah.
So
from at least certain individuals, it's very hard for me to imagine, three black men running down a white man, shooting him because they thought he was robbing a neighborhood, making a citizen's arrest. Right. And, you know, I mean, it's right. I don't think that these cases quite work, if the racial dynamics are reversed. Which is important, but yes, right. The state is kind of giving a nice nod here to this type of violence. Right, Rittenhouse was recently acquitted as well. So it's a pretty kind of gruesome story.
So to go back to this sort of idea of liberty and freedom being underneath all this, I mean, there's clearly an inconsistency in how this is being applied to different citizens. Be it because of their race or kind of political orientation or immigrant status or whatever. So how are we to try and understand these claims of freedom from the right? So you have in a piece that you wrote soon after the Capitol insurrection in 2020 by Trump supporters, you say this thing, and I quote, "The events of this month underscored that freedom, that most signature of conservative values, has been refashioned to contain violence at its core, freedom to carry a gun and use it at will, to infect others around you during a pandemic, to die of a preventable disease rather than submit to a national healthcare system," end quote. But these are all freedoms that in some way are not for everyone, right? This kind of like freedom to carry a gun and use it at will, mm-hmm. as you just said. Well, if you're black and you do that, I'm not sure you're going to have the same response from police or the law in a court as, say, if you're white, if you're a middle class business owner or whatever. So how should we understand this concept of liberty in play here? Is it just deeply inconsistent at its core? What's going on?
I mean, certainly it like all other aspects of kind of American culture, particularly American politics on the right, it is highly racialized. So yes, it is exclusionary. Not necessarily that we shouldn't look for some sort of logic to it, but that it's just not necessarily the logic that's being advanced here. And that, right, if I was to try to put a pin in it and say, what is it that kind of distinguishes this kind of this new coalition of right-wing forces? And that differentiates mm-hmm. them from, say, like, you know, either kind of the libertarians or, you know, kind of more traditional conservative forces. Is that this new right, and it's right, it's a new old right, because this is the logic itself is highly fascist. It really relishes violence in a way that I think is distinct. And I argue that it's ultimately part of a kind of authoritarian and like really anti-democratic ethos, that animates this new coalition of forces, where violence has been refashioned into the primary form of civic agency. Meaning what? Meaning we don't actually want people to govern. We don't want people to be involved in substantive ways in kind of running the show. But we do want them to harm. We do want them to kind of be foot soldiers in enacting this new kind of far right order. And if you think about the things that really animate the new right, it's like, what is the substance of this, right? It's like owning the libs on Twitter but from everything from this to, mm-hmm. you know, really storming the Capitol with zero plan as to how one might govern if you achieved, if you were to actually overturn these elections, right? Threatening to execute your political opponents. I see this as really a politics of spectacle that's devoid of any sort of kind of positive content, that doesn't actually have a worldview about, right, well, how exactly should our life be? What are the social conditions that we want to prevail? It is really, really focused on violence as the premier form of belonging.
So violence is the point, not even the means comes to achieving an end.
I do think that is the case, and which is what I think that is, you know, one of the places where much of this is ultimately quite nihilist. I mean, right, and this is not, again, this doesn't characterize all parts of, you know, the kind of this new far right. I think you have the national conservatives that are trying to put forth a vision. However kind of repugnant I might find it, it is a vision, right, of a traditional kind of society ordered around moral values, you know, kind of strong families, so on and so forth, right? A kind of nostalgia for the factory, mm-hmm. the factory worker, single salary of yore. I think though that you look at like these forces that are kind of in play in that kind of storming of the Capitol, that the violence is the point, the spectacle of it is the point. And I think about this when I like consider how being a gun owner has become an identity category in recent decades, in a way which I think is also kind of unique in, again, even though it builds clearly on earlier history and earlier trends. But, you know, the idea that, you know, a firearm use is constitutive of the self, which is something that you see all over kind of American gun culture today. I mean, I find this as just, again, like I grew up in a gun culture, I would say not the one that exists today. Not that it was like, you know, morally superior or anything like this, but that it was certainly just different. This was, and so it's striking to see people kind of fashion their identity in these terms that are so directly connected to the exercise or the potential exercise of violence.
Do you see this as being sort of, because what you're saying, I take it there is a sort of apparent nihilistic aspect to all this, but it also sounds like you're saying that like owning a gun gives you meaning, or it gives meaning to some people, right? It gives them a sense of identity.
Yes.
And I was wondering whether it's sort of like part of this idea of seeing yourself as a kind of true American because you're exercising your constitutional right to own guns, and that somehow, you know, in doing this performatively, you exercise your Americanness in some way, and that in itself is kind of meaning giving to people who've kind of, you know, lost meaning elsewhere, maybe in the workplace, maybe through religion. I don't know, you know, there's a kind of whole set of deteriorations of spaces of meaning and sociality and so on. But do you see those things kind of in tension, that on one hand the politics is nihilistic, but sort of at the core of it is also this kind of like hunger for meaning by the people behind it?
No, I mean, I think that those things are actually compatible. But the lack of articulating what that meaning might be, or what that life again might look like in any sort of like positive quality, is right. It is what gives rise to some of these morbid symptoms. The sense of really not seeing an alternative way of, right, because it's not necessarily about creating a social alternative or a political alternative, but like pure destruction. I would just say that on the kind of question also of identity, I mean, this was so apparent at the January 6th, this Capitol, you know, storming, where you have all of these kind of, you know, people coming in costume as Revolutionary War figures, like literally cosplaying the role of kind of founding fathers. But again, it's like so reductive, because it's not founding fathers in their capacity as, right, essayists or drafters of constitutional amendments. It is literally just the kind of militarism that remains, just the kind of the acting out of violence.
One of the distinctions that you draw in your writings, and maybe we're too deep into the conversation to introduce it now, but you draw this distinction between private violence and public violence. And I was wondering what these two different kinds are, and how do you think this distinction is important in kind of trying to understand what's going on?
Well, I mean, I think I'll say two things. One, that it's right, this is probably never existed in practice, in material terms. It is a liberal ideal, right? A social contract, right, is a device for creating a sovereign that will control the use of violence, with the idea that, you know, we, rather than everyone acting as their own kind of private vigilante, that we'll have a sovereign force that will uphold law and order. This kind of basic, you know, principle of liberalism. And of course, it's, you know, kind of reaches the most famous expression in the Weberian idea of the state, you know, possessing this legitimate monopoly on the use of violence. So this is the ideal. Now, there's, of course, a question as to whether such a ideal has ever existed in practice. And certainly instances like the U.S., this kind of, you know, really a settler colonial state that practiced slavery, makes that distinction between theory and practice, I think, even more difficult to sustain and far more uneven. Because you do have individuals who are deputized as agents of the state. I mentioned kind of the case of the South Dakota previously. So this was one way in which the kind of, you know, the kind of middle section of the whole, you know, the Great Plains was cleared out of indigenous peoples was through deputizing individual white settlers to act as these kind of vigilante, army and military forces. So I do think, you know, we always have to be attentive to the way that these ideals may or may not actually correspond to a reality. But I also, I'm not entirely willing to give up on this ideal. I think that, you know, that we do want to aspire toward democratic control over violence. And that the, that is not something that is kind of, that should be kind of thrown out or kind of abandoned, because I'm not sure what we replace that with. But certainly these, you know, I've kind of written that something that we are seeing here as this kind of, as kind of liberal forms of political and social life are kind of clearly in crisis and breaking down, is that this distinction between public and private violence is also getting very difficult to sustain. And this is not just something that's happening in the U.S., really, it's something that's happening worldwide.
So this is going back to sort of early modern thinkers like Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, and the idea that somehow the state is supposed to be the central wielder of violence and control the legitimate use of violence and kind of prevent, for Hobbes, that's the whole point of having a state, is to
I think it's important, though, to say that whatever's happening, whatever's coming after liberalism, right, it's not going to be a return. This is never, these such returns are never possible in historical time. However much this distinction is kind of breaking down and kind of forms of sovereignty, you know, liberal sovereignty and statehood are kind of breaking down, what's going to replace them is not a kind of Hobbesian state of nature. What looks more likely to replace them is that a kind of minority faction will gain control of the state and use the mechanisms of state power to enforce its will on an unwilling majority. So it is not that sovereignty is disappearing or state power is disappearing. It's just that that ideal or the dream that we may have true democratic control over the state, the use of state violence, that is what is receding. But state violence is intensifying. It's just that it will be increasingly controlled by kind of minoritarian factions.
You argue that it's not... You say, you know, it's an observation, I guess, that the mechanisms of liberalism that were deployed in the past to contain violence are no longer adequate. And here I'm also reading a quote from you. We can see them breaking down. And you say we can see them breaking down both practically and ideologically. And so practically, I guess, we can see it. You know, the state has kind of lost control in some ways of violence within its, you know, within its kind of grounds and land. In what way do you see this breaking down ideologically as well? Because as you said, well, what's the alternative if we don't have a kind of state that is responsible for the legitimate use of violence and that those decisions are somehow democratically accountable? What's the alternative? So where do you kind of see this ideological breakdown of this module?
I mean, I'll go away from kind of just U.S. domestic politics for a second. Sure. And mention the, right, we've had two very costly and really disastrous, wars over the last, two two plus decades here. And how have they been fought? Have they been fought with just a, have they been fought with a draft? Certainly no. Have they even been fought with a, you know, large deployments of U.S. forces? Yes. But a lot of people are surprised to know that even at their peak, you know, private military companies, contractors consistently outnumber the number of U.S. forces in all of these different war theaters. Mm-hmm. And so I look, for instance, the way that violence is being deployed at the state level, the international level, at the kind of, you know, level of war making, and say that, right, there's been a persistent argument since the 90s that the private sector will be more nimble, will be able to essentially skirt democratic oversight in the way that the kind of regular U.S. forces are subjected to, and thus this type of warfare waged by, you know, contractors and private military companies is perfectly aligned with a war that is fought without democratic oversight and preferably out of view entirely. Right, as invisible as possible, which has been a kind of abiding feature of the war on terror. So really practically at the largest level of state violence and the kind of question of a, you know, monopoly on violence, we don't have it anymore, right? We have, you know, huge portions of, you know, U.S.'s kind of war making being undertaken by private military companies for mass profits, but seemingly, right, little public good or public effect, but also next to zero public oversight or public scrutiny. Is that an ideological breakdown or is that a material breakdown? I mean, it's both, because it comes from an ideology that stressed that the free market is the best, right, that the free market principles can and should be applied to all facets of government, and that as much as many political processes as possible should be taken out of the hands of the people, should be taken out of kind of democratic control and subjected to market principles.
Do you see this as a sort of genuine expression of this kind of like liberal philosophy or politics? You know, we've mentioned people like Locke, Rousseau here, and their kind of descendants, say, I don't know, John Rawls? Or do you see it as a kind of perversion of liberalism, more towards this kind of distorted neoliberal libertarian style where the state is supposed to be shrunk as much as possible and the market take over as much as possible of the activity?
It is certainly a neoliberal kind of instantiation, and, you know, which obviously like builds on, but is not entirely this, right? It's quite, with it, Milton Friedman is not John Rawls. There are distinctions here to be made. But it's not libertarian. And I think that that's like really important to underscore, because it's not that the state shrinks. The state redeploys, the state shrinks in terms of kind of any sort of social provision. So we kind of cut education funding, we cut, you know, any kind of measly funding for healthcare. We ensure that the United States, you know, continues to not have a system of universal healthcare, of paid family leave, of any sort of just like, you know, basic supports for individuals and for families. All of these things are on the chopping block as part of the kind of small state and the idea that the, you know, that the marketplace will magically redistribute its goodies to those who are most deserving. But certainly the state as a whole, I don't think we can say it's fair to say it shrinks, because during the same exact time, the spending on military and policing and prisons expands dramatically. So the state becomes more punitive, and it becomes more punitive. I think I don't think this is like a mystery as to why these two things happen in tandem. As the social order becomes increasingly precarious and increasingly unequal, then more and more violence is required to uphold it. And that is what the state does. It's a more a process of kind of state capture and redeployment than a kind of genuine shrinking of the government and of small government. And right. So yeah, some of this is even using the term liberalism is confusing in American context, because Americans, right, associate liberalism with, like, you know, like Hillary Clinton or something. It's like, no. We're talking about a longer political philosophy. We're talking about kind of a broader set of principles. And certainly we're talking about the neoliberals. But what is happening right now, I think, that we can see is these, right, a whole assortment of morbid symptoms, to use that old Gramscian language, that kind of point to the breakdown of this order, both of the kind of liberal order and the kind of neoliberal order that superseded it, that built on many of its foundations and challenged and overturned many of them. But both of these things are going by the wayside right now. And you know, you see this very strongly in the kind of new assortment of right forces, thinkers, figures who reject neoliberalism, who say, no, actually the free market has not done the things that we want it to do. It has led to, you know, families being, you know, the kind of weakening of the family unit, which is the basic unit of society. It's led to all of this kind of free trade and, like, international migration, which is diluting the national character of, you know, various societies, that, you know, neoliberalism is also the enemy of this new right. And that the, you know, I'm writing about this in another context right now, but it's very, very fascinating. If you think about liberalism as trying to be this balancing act in its kind of, you know, classical forms between equality and freedom, which, you know, de Tocqueville kind of tells us our intention, right? To have kind of, you know, liberty, having perfect liberty and perfect equality being kind of, both of them are liberal impulses, but they pull in different directions. And that the, you know, project of liberalism has been one of trying to kind of strike a balance between those two. Whereas the kind of project that neoliberalism took up was, you know, siding on the quote unquote, the side of freedom, by which they meant market freedom, and just produced this kind of, you know, massive inequality that we see. But the new right isn't interested in these terms of debate at all. Because actually the vision in the new, like, social and political vision they have, they're going to solve that old conundrum of the feud between liberty and equality by doing away with both. And that is where, I see us so heading.
Tyranny and inequality as the new,
ideals. Right. It will be an authoritarian capitalism with, you know, with kind of modest state policies and redistribution towards those who are deemed kind of part of the real nation. Again, you see this in very advanced in place like Hungary, which is of course like it is idealized by the American right as this, you know, almost like wonderland where all your dreams are possible, things that you never thought you could do. Look, they're doing them in Hungary, and that, I think that is the direction here. And so this is certainly, we are seeing like the breakdown of an old social order, of an old political order. And we are getting these glimpses as to, you know, what are the things on deck to replace them. And they are quite terrifying.
Since we started this discussion with the Supreme Court kind of ruling, do you see the role of the Supreme Court in the next few years as kind of pivotal in moving things in that direction?
Yes. I think what's important about the Supreme Court ruling, we started kind of talking about in particular this the kind of most recent gun ruling, is that, right, this comes in the midst of a number of other rulings, most famously, you know, probably the overturning of Roe versus Wade, kind of a right to abortion at the federal level, but we can put this alongside rulings on voting rights or election finance or climate change, the EPA, their ability to kind of, you know, regulate for the sake of kind of environmental safety. In each one of these things, the Supreme Court is really showing its cards as the premier kind of counter-majoritarian force in American politics. And it's really fascinating to just see how far apart the Supreme Court is from what we consistently see of kind of popular polling, which has, you know, pretty consistently shown that many Americans, including, I will say, many Republicans, many gun owners, favor, you know, far more expansive range of gun safety measures than politicians have been able to legislate. I was just looking at some of these numbers to get ready for our chat today. And, you know, we have a Pew Research survey from April of 2021, where you have 81% of respondents nationwide who favor expanded background checks, over 70% favoring these kind of red flag laws, 63% favoring a ban on assault weapons. So you have like clear majorities and even super majorities in favor of various policies, and the Supreme Court sees it as its role basically to take any sort of like modicum movement on these issues that are an expression of democratic will and overturn them. And it said it's not just the guns, it's the abortion, it's kind of things regarding, you know, again, like voting and environmental protections, so on and so forth. So I think it's important to see the Supreme Court as part of this broader counter-majoritarian strategy that the right has been quite methodically building in the U.S. really since the 1980s. And it makes quite a good deal of sense. If your positions are not actually popular at the electoral level, what better way to achieve the, you know, some sort of hegemony than within the judiciary, particularly within the Supreme Court, which, of course, you know, appointed, has to be approved by the Senate, another great counter-majoritarian American institution, and that can overturn these attempts to legislate the democratic will. And right, the no term limits, lifetime appointments, all of these things. You know, my colleague at the Brooklyn Institute, Ajay Singh Chaudhary, has for years been referring to the Supreme Court as America's own guardian council. And I do think that there is something quite quite true about and quite telling about that kind of characterization, that people are beginning to actually see that the extent to which that is the case, that this is a not a kind of an expression of democratic institutions that will kind of save us from tyranny, as I think was often the hope after Donald Trump was initially elected, but really that the institutions themselves are kind of part of the problem, and that they are designed with this kind of democracy deficit in play, and that, you know, and that the Supreme Court in particular has, you know, has this now starring role in kind of ensuring that a minority agenda is enacted kind of on the majority.
I couldn't sort of end this discussion without asking you about your experience on an NRA training course. And I think it's sort of relevant here to the points that you were just making, because traditionally we think of the NRA as being this extremely powerful lobbying group, which manages to influence politics in a way that doesn't reflect the kind of general will, if you like. So it wields disproportionate sort of political influence on, in particular, the Republican Party, and presumably some of the decisions that end up being made in the Supreme Court. But it also has this other role, which is to sort of spread its kind of ideology and gun culture amongst the population. So not just influencing kind of the top politicians and senators and so on, but also just sort of ordinary citizens who have maybe some kind of interest in guns, and then they sort of, you know, go for a training course and are given this kind of ideological rundown. Yeah. So could you tell us about a little bit about your experience on this training course, and what did you find out? What did it reveal to you about all this?
I went to this training in the fall of 2019, and is a particular type of training. And this seminar in particular was called "Refuse to be a Victim." And "Refuse to be a Victim" is fascinating because it is not actually a gun. It's not a gun use course at all. Right, you sit in a conference room or in an office and like watch a slideshow about how unsafe you are. Like that is the meat of this is, you know, in some ways quite distinct from these kind of like, you know, basic rifle shooting or something like this that was, you know, more of the historic kind of like bread and butter of the NRA.
This is not a practice course, it's a theory course.
This is a theory course. I could not get out of my head how much this felt like a like souped up version of, in New York City after 9/11, we had this, you know, slogan, if you see something, say something. that kind of speaks to this idea that every individual is kind of, you know, part of preserving the safety of the homeland. And we all have this kind of, you know, responsibility to be vigilant in the public sphere. And so I got interested in this because really what this class was a course in risk assessment, how you individual can, you know, start to think like a counterterrorism agent or an FBI agent and assess all of the threats that may or may not really be lurking around you. And it quickly veers into just territory, which is pure paranoia. Right. I had these incredible exchanges with, you know, this sense of the outside world as completely hostile strangers. What is strange and unknown is always being out to do you harm. I remember I asked my instructor, you know, about like, well, if I ever ran out of gas, you know, when I'm like visiting my parents in upstate New York, for instance, like, what should I do? I would have certainly just hitched a ride to the gas station when I was, you know, 18 years old in South Dakota. And he's like, well, the police will never find your body up there. You know, it's so densely wooded. You know, it was so beyond paranoid and really expressed this view of the social world as hostile, particularly, again, that which is other, that which is strange, that which is foreign is hostile. Because here's a 3.5-hour training. I never heard anything about the risks of domestic violence. I never heard anything about intimate partner abuse, which statistically, right, as a woman, I would be far more likely to be facing than, you know, some random stranger picking me up and murdering me and throwing me into the woods. And so it speaks a lot, again, both to this risk assessment framework that has become so pervasive and that I'm actually writing about in my next book project, and just how much that is racialized, how much the kind of constructions of the other function there, and then all of the sources of risk and harm and danger which are not spoken about. Because if threats and danger always must come from without, then of course you're not very attentive to that which might even lurk within. So the course was definitely a wild experience. It took me a while to process what had just occurred in it and to kind of speak of it in terms as kind of like organized as this. I don't want you to think that I was able to do that right off the bat, because it was actually just it wasn't scarring, but it was really it was memorable, right. And it was uncanny in many regards in the moment.
And presumably no mention of the risk of actually owning a gun, which, you know, again, statistics kind of show that you're much more likely
certainly that was not there. I mean, and to kind of, you know, keep on the right thinking about these things in a international frame, right? And I mentioned the war on terror and this idea of kind of if you see something, say something, as being this kind of mindset that all individuals should embrace, right? My class was taught by a retired New York City counterterrorism officer. And it was just, you know, it was almost like perfect confluence of the kind of the foreign and the foreign policy and the domestic kind of coming home to roost in this really, ungainly way.
So a final question is, what's a book that you'd recommend to someone to kind of understand a little bit more about the politics of gun culture in America or the politics of gun violence in the States?
So, there are a lot of them. The one that I think is, I mentioned earlier in this podcast, Jennifer Carson's Citizen Protectors, I think does a very, very good job at talking, both kind of through the history, but also through, you know, some of the dynamics I'm identifying here in terms of the individual kind of as deputy of state violence. So the individual is responsible for their own security. And I would be remiss if I did not mention that my colleague at the Brooklyn Institute, Patrick Blanchfield, has a new book coming out called Gun Power from Verso, which is also going to be a wonderful kind of, tour de force of the constitutive role of guns and gun culture in American life.
Suzanne Snyder, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Philosopher in the News. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. The link is in the show notes. You can also help us by sharing this podcast episode on social media to help spread the word. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. I hope we speak again soon.